Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. It's good to be back on air. Got back on yesterday. New York continues to struggle. We talked about it yesterday on the program. And I think ordinary New Yorkers and other people in New Jersey and other affected areas, a good many of them are going to suffer for a long time to come. I don't see any quick resolution to things for them. Could be an ugly situation for the people most vulnerable. We discussed that yesterday. Today, we could touch on it. We might touch on anything during the hour, but we absolutely want to talk about a book that I'm looking right at, sitting right in front of me. Oh, it's an absolute must-read. Got to go out and get it, but I'll let my guest tell you about it. He's Andy Roth. He is the director of Project Censored. I'm sorry, the associate director of Project Censored. He works with the director of Project Censored, Mickey Huff. And Mickey comes on this program often. I'll get him back. I'm trying to arrange a date for Mickey to come back as soon as my schedule meshes with his. Mickey and I exchanged a few emails this morning. Andy, it's great to have you on. I'll just mention that you're a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University, where Peter Phillips is. And a few years ago, I was at Sonoma State University. Don't get to that part of the world too often, but I did back in 2008. It was a lovely experience. But it's great to have you on.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's a pleasure to join you on the Progressive Radio News Hour.
Oh, it's terrific to have you and anybody from Project Censored and everything that we do on this program, Andy. We try very hard to get key guests like yourself and talk about the big issues. And Censored 2013, my God, it's cover to cover big issues, and it's a huge book. It's got so much in it. It's a collector's item. It really is a collector's item, and anybody can dive into any section of the book at any topic, any area, whatever, and read things and go back and refer to them. And that's what really makes these annual censored books so wonderful. You can go back and look at old ones, Andy, and the stuff is so timely. You know, I mean, the same things seem to be going on. We just need to update them. You know, Afghanistan, I don't know how many times Afghanistan came up in Project Censored books over the last 10, 11 years. But my goodness, if it came up a decade ago, I mean, it could have come up every year. But Andy, let me let you talk about the book.
Yeah, well, this is the Censored 2013 book is just out. It's our latest in the annual editions of the top censored stories and media analysis, as founder Carl Jensen used to refer to it, the news that didn't make the news. And Mickey and I and all the contributors to this year's book are real proud, if I may say, of what we've accomplished. We think we've put together one of the best Project Censored books yet. There is, sad to say, no shortage of news that the corporate media have failed to cover altogether or failed to cover in a complete and impartial way. And on the more positive side, the book is really a celebration of the work of independent journalists and the organizations such as Progressive Radio Network that allow independent journalists to get their stories out to the public so that we can be informed and proactive members of our communities and indeed of the society and the global community as well. So, it's great to have the book finally out and such a pleasure to get to talk and your audience.
It really is so important. And there was an article I wrote a few weeks ago where I referred to what's going on now as possibly the most perilous time in world history. I mean, we have multiple wars going on. We have nuclear weapons that powers like America think of as king-size hand grenades. I'm not altogether not certain that the small nuclear weapons, maybe bunker busters, haven't been used multiple times long after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. More recently, post 9/11, depleted uranium, of course, is used in all U.S. munitions and vast parts of the countries that America has conquered and occupied are irradiated, so you have cancer epidemics going on there, but you never see a word about it in what I call, Andy, the scoundrel media. I can't think of a better name than that. I mean, they're scoundrels. They prevent readers from knowing the most important stuff of all, and even when they touch on a vital issue. I drafted an article this morning that I'll get out. I'll put it aside for a little bit. I've got a couple of others I want to get out tomorrow. But I wrote an article on Bahrain. I've written a number about Bahrain in the past. There was a brand new Washington Post editorial, and there was a New York article, a New York Times article dated October 30, that actually had some good information in it, except they only went so far and then they stopped. And the most important stuff that I have in my article, they didn't even touch on.
Yeah, well, one of the, you know, our cartoonist again this year is the non-parallel Khalil Ben Deeb, and one of the cartoons he drew for specifically for the book this year is a cartoon of journalists. It's a room where there's just a disaster has gone on. There's whitewash on the wall. There's trash spilled on the floor. There's shredded documents in one corner of the room. There's a dead body hidden under a carpet labeled election fraud and corporate malfeasance. And the janitor, who's labeled the corporate media in Khalil's cartoon, is asking, "Project Censored? Here in America? What for?" Right? And meanwhile, the skeletons are coming out of the closet labeled 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. So, to move from Ben Deeb's cartoon to substance, Steve, as you know, every year one of the features of the book is what we call junk food news. And we look at what the corporate media is reporting, and we compare that with what they could be reporting. And this was something that Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University started decades ago. After Project Censored was underway, when people in the corporate media came back to Professor Jensen, and they said, you know, it's not really fair. We just don't have enough column inches in the paper. We don't have enough time during the broadcast to cover all the important news. So it's not censorship, it's story selection, they said, in effect, to Carl. And Carl Jensen said, well, that's interesting. So, and he sent his students to look at what the corporate media were covering. And he came up on looking at a range of that with this concept of junk food news, the idea of news that is titillating and enticing, but not necessarily, in effect, nutritious for us as citizens. So here's an example from this year's book, Steve. In May of 2012, this may sound like ancient history now, but real estate mogul Donald Trump drew attention once again to the status of President Obama as an American-born citizen. Trump continued to be fixated on Obama's birth certificate, and he called once again for Obama to prove that he'd been born in the United States. And this was at the height of the Republicans attempting to figure out who their candidate was going to be, of course, and Trump was known at that time as a major supporter of Mitt Romney and his campaign, and there was sensational, pervasive coverage of whether Trump's remarks were going to damage Romney's campaign, sensational coverage about whether Obama's campaign would capitalize on this association between Romney and Trump, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, what broadcast media and other factions of the establishment press were not covering was actually quite an important New York Times story that came out on May 29th of this year, documenting how President Obama was personally involved in drone strikes on specific individuals in the decision-making on those strikes, and how his administration had embraced a highly debatable, deeply problematic method of counting civilian casualties that result from those strikes.
You're talking about his kill list, Andy.
Exactly. So at a time when the corporate media were fanning the burnt-out embers of debate over Obama's citizenship, they largely ignored what we report as smoking gun evidence of the Obama administration's willingness to embrace a radical redefinition of who's a civilian in ways that legitimated this global drone campaign that the U.S. is engaged in. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting looked at this looked at the lack of coverage in other corporate media of the New York Times article, and they said, quote, what was more newsworthy than the president personally approving drone strikes on specific individuals? And the FAIR actually issued a media advisory noting that only among all the major networks, only CBS had even mentioned this report. So that's the kind of thing we're up against, I think, in terms of whatever we call the corporate media. They're feeding us one set of information and frameworks, and what we really need to understand our lives and our collective role in the world as U.S. Members of the United States is quite a different sort of information.
Andy, for certain that's true. And the first thing, the only way people can do anything about what's wrong with the way the country is run is to understand what's going on. And you certainly won't understand, usually, by reading the major newspapers or publications or tuning on your TV set and watching so-called TV news. Once in a while, something important slips through. I wrote about Obama's kill list. And there was a follow-up a couple of weeks ago that I wrote about his disposition matrix. The language kill list is pretty obvious. I don't think his administration officials called it that, but that's what it was. And I think the New York Times called it a kill list, which is an accurate way of describing it. And this notion of a disposition matrix. Well, disposition, you know, dispose of people. And John Brennan, his counterterrorism advisor, I call him Obama's maestro of murder, which is exactly what he is. They have they have weekly meetings.
Well, I mean, all the language around around the idea of this drone campaign, all this language is worthy of investigation. The idea that it's drone warfare. Well, warfare typically implies two relatively equally armed, relatively equally matched parties of combatants. But one of the key things about drones is that it's a completely asymmetrical form of warfare. There's no chance to strike back. I mean, there's a little news item this morning saying that Iran took shots at one of our Predator drones that was doing, quote, routine surveillance. But that's, again, not an equivalent kind of risk. The drone will kill people. Even if you hit the drone, it's just a piece of machinery. And the other, you know, the idea of these surgical strikes, the language suggesting a kind of clinical precision, and then most recently the most kind of disturbing use of these notions of signature strikes. And what is a signature in this case? Well, signature strikes are the latest kind of development in the use of the drones, especially in Pakistan, but also in Yemen, as I know you wrote about less than 24 hours after being reelected. It appears increasingly likely now that Obama had authorized a drone strike in Yemen that killed at least two or three people. We don't know the exact numbers because, of course, this is still officially a covert program. But the idea of these signature strikes where we aren't actually targeting specific individuals, but people who fit a general pattern of characteristics. And interesting thing to me is that back in June or July, Denis Kucinich and several of his 25 of his congressional colleagues, this is in June of 2012, they wrote a sharply worded letter to President Obama asking for clarification on these signature strikes. And one of the things the letter did is it referred to these drones as our faceless ambassadors. And I think that's such a powerful image, right? These are how we're representing ourselves to many people in many places around the world. And is this the image that we want to project abroad of what the United States is? But again, the idea of signature strikes, the language around all of this is so, you know, it's an overused phrase, but there's an Orwellian quality to this.
boy, it sure is. And a guest will be on this program. He's been on before. Another sociology professor at the University of Texas, Stepan Mestrovic, he wrote a book called The Good Soldier on Trial. And in the book, he wrote about how a commander, a colonel of a battalion, I think it was, in an area of Iraq, gave orders to his troops. And I assume the orders that he gave were the same orders that came down from other battalion commanders. And the order was very simple, Andy. Kill every military-aged Iraqi male on sight. What's a military-aged Iraqi male? A kid 12 years old? An old guy in the 60s? What's a military-aged Iraqi? In other words, yeah, the order was, you know, anybody that looks suspicious, women or men, kill them.
Yeah, and that's exactly that language of a military-aged male is exactly the language that we, due to persistent efforts by investigative journalists and civil liberties organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights, that we know, like, that has been the redefinition. Those people, a military-aged male, whatever that entails, which means roughly anyone from teenage to in their 60s or so, is now this was what was exposed in this report from May. They are considered militants. They are no longer, by the Obama administration's policies, considered civilians. And so this is how it was even remotely possible for people in the Obama administration to claim that there had been no civilian deaths due to drone strikes in Pakistan, because, in effect, a great majority of the population had been redefined as militants rather than civilians. So one of the things that I think is quite hopeful in the area around drones is this fantastic study out of New York University and Stanford, Living Under Drones, came out a little over a month ago, and one of their recommendations was that journalists and media outlets should cease the common practice of referring to militant deaths without explaining the government usage of that term militant, that it should acknowledge that the U.S. government counts all adult males killed by strikes as militants unless and until there is exonerating evidence to clear that particular person. And so that Living Under Drones study is fantastic and comprehensive, and that policy recommendation, although it's not the whole issue, would do a lot to help clarify, I think, the media coverage around this issue. My belief is, working at Project Censored and having written about this both for the 2013 book and in an editorial that we published earlier, is that until the American public knows more about the drone program, the figures indicating the great support of the American program, or the American public for the drone program, are illusory, right? It's people expressing support for something they don't actually know much about or understand the full implications of. And that obviously is that's a counter-democratic situation, right? The people have to know things. The people have to be informed before they can engage in truly democratic self-government. We, early in the book, we quote from the great journalist Walter Lippmann, who in a 1920 essay called Journalism and the Higher Law wrote this. Walter Lippmann writes, "All that the sharpest critics of democracy have alleged is true if there's no steady supply of trustworthy and relevant news. Incompetence and aimlessness, corruption and disloyalty, panic and ultimate disaster must come to any people which is denied an assured access to the facts. No one can manage anything on tap," such a great word, "neither can a people." Aside from the fact that Mickey Huff, the director of the project, and I were kind of enamored of this notion of PAP as a description of what the corporate media by and large produces us, the sentiment, the larger argument in that passage was something that we felt appropriate to the top 25 stories that we were bringing forward, and certainly relevant to any discussion about U.S. drone policy and the news coverage of it.
Well, absolutely, Andy, and I want to get to the stories. I will mention that I wrote about the New York University Stanford study, and the key fact that jumped out at me was the fact that the conclusion was, based on other information that the study obtained and included in their study, was that only 2% of the people killed were called high-level militants. So in other words, 98% of the people killed were others than the ones who were targeted. That's what that statement really means. Talk about an abysmal failure, killing the wrong people, and of course lying, bald-faced lies, claiming otherwise. But that really reflects on what's going on here at home, and I think a little bit about the Project Censored number one story. And for me, it reflects the arrival of tyranny in America.
Yeah, our number one story is the emergence of the signs of an emerging police state domestically here in the U.S. And so we're an increasingly monitored, and the American public is increasingly monitored, and the police forces that bring domestic security are increasingly militarized, and both of those at the expense of civil liberties. And so the most obvious of these is the National Defense Authorization Act. Project Censored was just involved last week. There was a one-page ad in The Nation trying to draw attention to the dangers, the ongoing threat posed by the NDAA. And that's an issue we continue to be concerned with. Lesser known but equally upsetting would be the National Defense Resources Preparedness Executive Order. And then the one that I always have to kind of smile as we talk about it, not because the program itself is laughable, but because of a little detail related to it. Since 2010, the Department of Homeland Security has had an "If You See Something, Say Something" campaign that encourages the public to report all suspicious activity to local authorities. And when you go to the DHS website and look at some of guidelines for what counts as suspicious in terms of activity, it includes the constitutionally protected right to criticize the government, to engage in nonviolent protest and whatnot. Well, there's nothing laughable about that, but if you see something, say something campaign, it always brings a little wry smile to my face. That is a trademarked slogan. When you see that, if you see something, say something, phrasing, it always appears with the little TM trademark symbol. And there's something to me about yes, we're talking about signs of an emerging police state, but also the notion of the kind of corporatization of the nation as well is captured symbolically with that little TM trademark signal. So you might think, for instance, that with NDAA, that would be the kind of thing that would get large coverage in the corporate media, right, fulfilling its role as the fourth estate, keeping vigilant watch on the government to ensure that there's not abuse of governmental power. But as Elliot Cohen, who wrote the Censored News Cluster on the police state and civil liberties for this year's book, writes, he says, coverage has tended to focus on whether or not President Obama was going to sign the NDAA bill. This is prior to it being signed, which, of course, he did on December 31st of last year. And so the coverage was not about what was in the bill, whether the bill was objectionable. It was just treated as a kind of, the equivalent of trying to guess the score on Sunday's football game. Is Obama going to sign it or is he not going to sign it? So that's a kind of a failure.
There's a very ugly story concerning that bill, and it really unfolded in chapters. I wrote a number of times on it myself, Andy. But, the police state laws and the police state justice in America didn't just happen under Obama or George Bush II or It happened under all of the previous presidents. You could go back to the inception of the Republic. But just in more modern times, in the 20th century, Sacco and Vanzetti, I mean, look at the injustice there. The Rosenbergs, gross injustice. You know, the government decides they want to go after somebody, and they can trump up any charges they want. They can have police state laws on the books to do it, or they can simply do what they want extrajudiciously or extra outside of the law. If there's no U.S. law that covers it, they simply can do whatever they want, and of course they have since the beginning of the Republic. I'm very mindful of what Clinton did. I forget the year. It might have been 1996. His anti-terrorism bill, it was the precursor to the Patriot Act, and it basically, it got the ball rolling on the same kind of things that the Patriot Act really hardened very much so, over 300-odd pages, and then the Homeland Security Act. And a few years ago, I wrote an article I called Police State America, and all I did was go back to the 9/11 era, the post-9/11 era, and just review the laws and the presidential executive orders and things called national security and president, I forget the exact name, national security and presidential directives relating to national security, where the president on his own can make decisions, and these become binding to one degree or another. And Bush decided he would call himself a unitary executive. That's an Orwellian term, Andy, for a despot, a unitary executive. In other words,
unitary sounds good. We need to be unified, right? We need to be coordinated, right? This language always has that appeal aspect, right? But yeah, you're quite right. You have to translate it to get the underlying meaning. Well, I'm thinking about this in terms of, I've been on a kick, Steve, of reading about democracy in ancient Greece lately, and thrilled with this book by Eli Sagan called The Honey and the Hemlock that came out about nearly 20 years ago now. The subtitle of the book is Democracy and Paranoia in Ancient Athens and Modern America. And one of his... So going back to ancient Greece, like I think you're quite right that the threat, the tendency towards the partial desire at least to kind of police things is somehow part of democracy. Sagan's thesis is in some ways that much as we like to believe otherwise, gross immorality is compatible with democracy. And, you know, we go all back to Pericles in ancient Athens, where there was, you know, there was incredible freedom for a certain segment of the Athenian population at home that was in some sense predicated on complete domination of the other city-states abroad. And he talks about, and it's incredible reading this book that was written 20 years ago, contemporary it seems. He talks about, paranoia is always about control and bodily, you know, in terms of the body, it's an obsession with what enters and what leaves and always a fear of being poisoned. And then you think about the body politic and there's the same dimension. So thinking about then signs of an emerging police state, another of our top 25 stories this year, our number four story, is that FBI agents are responsible for a majority of terrorist plots here in the United States. This was a story brought forward by Mother Jones and the investigative reporting program at the University of California, Berkeley, who documented how the FBI maintains a roster of some 15,000 spies or informants, many of whom are paid as much as $100,000 a case to, quote, stop terrorist plots. But the twist on all this is that the plots they're stopping are ones that they're, in some sense, instigating themselves. Right? This is a curious way to thwart terrorism. They're assisting, so these moles and informants are actually assisting, encouraging people to commit crimes, and then they the people, the alleged criminals, are in effect being set up. And this fits perfectly with an argument that Deepa Kumar makes in her book, her recent book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, that an external enemy, so the Al-Qaeda's, the Taliban, the Islamo-fascists, however we're going to refer to them, are paralleled internally by an equivalent enemy. And the FBI agents foiling these so-called terrorist plots domestically seem to fit Deepa Kumar's argument quite well. As again, as Elliot Cohen points out in his research, in his reporting on this story, if this is going to work as a strategy for the FBI to show how successful they are at protecting us from terrorism, from domestic attacks, the corporate media have to cooperate in reporting what the government spokespeople claim. And if they were to conduct their own independent investigations, this wouldn't occur. So what's interesting then is when you look at the corporate media coverage of the arrests domestically of people engaged in alleged acts of terrorism, the corporate media coverage has tended to neglect the frequency with which the judges throw these cases out when they get to court. And the corporate media coverage is emphasizing the cases that do go to trial. So we're getting this kind of skewed picture of, on the surface level, the FBI is making all these arrests, so we're safer. And then on the deeper level, that when these cases go to court, in most cases, the judges find the charges and the evidence laughable, not even worthy of going to trial over. So that, too, is part of the picture of, if we're going to talk about the state of civil liberties in the United States and how that is linked to, whether we have it or whether we're on our way to it, a police state, this notion, again, of enemies without and enemies within and a kind of paranoia about it, it's all part of a comprehensive picture.
Andy, this is another topic that absolutely obsesses me, and I've written literally about many dozens of individual cases. The ones that I wrote about, these people were all framed, they were entrapped, they were FBI stings, and you're right. They get hold of either a convicted felon or somebody up for charges that could put them in prison for a number of years, a good number of years, and they cut a deal with them, and they pay them huge amounts of money. You're right, it can be six figures, $100,000, and they either get leniency or they get a reduced sentence, and they lie. They lie for the government, and they say things that never happened, and they entrap innocent people, and they go to trial, and the ones that I've written about did not do too very well in court. And the only ones that a couple that I remember did better than others. There were some Haitians I wrote about. They were either exonerated or they were hung juries for two trials, but the prosecutors were so hell-bent on convicting them that they simply recharged them twice. A double jeopardy prevents being charged again on the same offense, but they simply repackaged the charges and went back three times, and they finally got them convicted. And the original charges that I wrote about, they accused them of wanting to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. These were kids living down in Miami. The Sears Tower in Chicago? They probably never even heard of the Sears Tower.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we, in the book, we quote Martin Stolar, who represented suspects similarly accused of plotting a bombing in New York City. Again, another of these instances that was allegedly set up by FBI agents. And Stolar, the defendant, says, the problem with the cases we're talking about is that the defendant would not have done anything if not kicked in the ass by government agents. They're creating crimes to solve crimes so they can claim a victory in the war on terror, right? So the FBI creates crimes to solve, and all in the rubric. So, we actually have brief mention of that Chicago Sears Tower case as well. It's It's just outrageous.
There were so many. The most infamous for me, it's so hard to pick the worst because they're all so bad. But the one that really bothered me the most was Afia Siddiqui. It's mostly men, Andy. And nearly every time they're Muslim men as part of America's war on Islam. Anybody who says that Obama, that he respects all the religions of the world and freedom of religion and so on, what a bunch of rot. I mean, Muslims, you know, in the olden days, it was the communists and it was the... it could have been the labor activists, the civil rights activists, and now it's Muslims. And Muslims are the enemy of choice, not necessarily because the people here hate Muslims, but they need to arouse fear. So do you arouse fear by creating enemies that don't exist? And Muslims are today's communists, and you have one case after another. And these people are literally guilty by accusations. And the scoundrel media, they report these stories like these are bad people, and the government found them out just in time. Every single time, Andy, nobody ever thinks about this, but every single time the FBI foiled the plot before it happened. You mean there wasn't one real bad guy out there that was smart enough to pull off something big and not get caught until after he did it?
Right, right.
None that I ever wrote about.
Right, and I would add, in addition to the American Muslim population, also animal rights activists. They're the other ones who are really getting hit hard as, in effect, the domestic terrorists. And so we wrote in last year's book, in the 2012, Censored 2012, we wrote some about how the these communication management units, which are sort of outright solitary confinement, some of the most restricted forms of imprisonment in the utilized by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and disproportionately, as the Center for Constitutional Rights and other civil liberties groups have shown, disproportionately the people housed in these communication management units are Muslims and also animal rights activists. And so they're under the strongest of restrictions in terms of, as the title, communication management units. Some of these policies have changed, but they're limited to mailing one letter a week and one 15-minute phone call per month. And they can receive only one 60-minute visit per month. So these are incredible forms of isolation associated with being located in one of these, again, the language, the communication management units. And so these are things that are clearly run afoul of the U.S. Constitution as forms of cruel and unusual punishment. And when you look at who the population is in these CMUs, it fits exactly what you just said, Steve. We're talking about largely a Muslim population and, to a lesser extent, animal rights activists.
And some environmental activists as well, Andy. I mean, people who want to defend the earth or defend animal rights, they get in trouble with the federal authorities. And the federal authorities work with the state and local authorities. And for the first time, there's a provision in the Patriot Act that for the first time ever created the crime of domestic terrorism. And they were thinking of these people, I hate to use the word militant, they're committed environmentalists and committed animal rights activists, committed for justice for the earth, and for animals, the same as for human beings. And these people are labeled terrorists. That is in the Patriot Act.
Yeah, and we actually, another aspect of the book that we do every year, we have a chapter called Deja Vu News, where we go back and look at what's happened with stories we've reported in either the previous year's book or previous years. And this year, one of our updates is on our one of our top 25 stories from 2008, which was when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It's met fierce resistance. There's an ongoing lawsuit, Bloom versus Holder, in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. Will Potter, Green is the New Red, has reported ceaselessly on these issues. The government was attempting to dismiss Bloom versus Holder. And again, we see the pattern is here. The corporate media coverage, when they do cover it, tends to marginalize it. We see activists described as, quote, misguided animal rights militants, and as indeed terrorists who are attacking, and they haven't been held. You know, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act has not kept them from dealing with it. And the quite interesting thing here, Jen Iden, who's a Project Censored student intern, wrote the update on that story. And she went back to the original, one of the original reports was brought forward by David Hawk and Odette Wilkins. And they, in their report for Censored 2008, reported that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, quote, would serve as a template for further limitations on the free speech of all activists. And when you think about the NDAA, H.R. 347, the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act, and other legislation that we've seen, Hawk and Wilkins, they called it. They saw the writing on the wall, that what we're seeing is this continued pattern of infringement on rights to speech, press, and assembly, threats to citizens who act on those rights, and indeed, ultimately, the idea that those people who act on those rights may be deemed by the government to be terrorists. So it's another case where I come back again and again to a line from the late folk singer and powerful advocate of working people and the organization of working people, Utah Phillips, who always said that the long memory is the most radical idea. Right? And in this case, maybe we have to modify Utah Phillips' observation to acknowledge that, well, given the state of America, even remembering back 4 years now may count at least partly as a bit of a long memory. The threads of these things run deep.
Yeah, it sure does, Andy. Mention a few of the other top stories and the top 25.
Well, I mean, since we were talking about the environment, our number two story is oceans. The world's oceans are in peril, and we start with imagery from a fantastic article by Julia Witte, who's a past Censored Award winner for her reporting on the state of the world's oceans. She writes in a recent article in the Natural Resource Defense Council journal On Earth, "We thought the sea was infinite and inexhaustible. It is not." And we go on and report two scientific findings indicating the perilous nature of the world's oceans right now. The first of these was reported in The Telegraph out of the UK, scientific research showing that the rise in the ocean's temperatures is leading to the largest movement of marine species documented in some 2 to 3 million years. And this is based on research by scientists at the Climate Change and European Marine Ecosystems Research Project. Now, you might look at that and say, migration of ocean species, what's so perilous about that? And if we're talking about progressives, aren't we constantly arguing for greater ability of humans to migrate? And we have a double standard. We don't want marine creatures to be able to migrate as well. Well, the science is not as flip as that. The discoveries of this research team is that delicate marine food webs will be unbalanced due to these migrations. In some cases, what we're talking about are the migration of tiny plankton that are invasive when they cross from the Pacific to the Atlantic, crossing through a newly developed passage in the Arctic Sea. And the fear is that with the introduction, for instance, of these invasive plankton, we will see as the scientists report, quote, widespread changes in the Atlantic Ocean's food web. One of the project's leaders, Dr. Carlo Hype, says we can expect, quote, damaging upheaval as we overturn the workings of a system that's so complex and important. These migrations are an example of how changing climate conditions cause species to move or change their behavior, leading to shifts in ecosystems. So we're talking about shifts in entire ecosystems here. So that's one dimension of the perilous condition of our world's oceans, linked specifically to climate change. The other is, in some sense, the other story we report in this Oceans in Peril number two story is in some ways a more positive or hopeful set of findings. This is from scientific research published in the online open access journal PLOS One, the Public Library of Science. And Enrique Sala and a group of his colleagues studied 14 protected ecosystems in the Mediterranean Sea, and they compared those 14 protected areas to 18 unprotected ones. And what they found was, over a period of 3 years of research, they found that in the areas where there were well-enforced reserves, fish populations were 5 to 10 times greater than fish populations in the unprotected areas. And this research then is a clear indication of how effective the establishment and maintenance of marine reserves can be. And that, to me, is a kind of good news story. It says, in effect, that if we choose to, if we commit ourselves to it, we can relate to ecosystems in a way that isn't inherently damaging, that isn't necessarily unsustainable. And so Sala, the leader of this study of the Mediterranean Sea that I've been describing, he says, the protection of marine ecosystems is a necessity as well as a business in which everyone wins. The reserves act as savings accounts with capital that is not yet spent and an interest yield we can live off of. And I think more and more, I have taught in the past at Sonoma State and elsewhere a class on environmental sociology, and one of the things we've wrestled with, my students and I, when we think about the environment from a sociological perspective is a kind of new strand of economic thinking about the environment that says, well, let's calculate the value of undisturbed ecosystems so that if we were to disturb them, we could, in effect, consider the opportunity costs of what we're losing. And to me, this Mediterranean Sea study is a nice exemplification of, well, you know, as Sala says, these reserves act as a kind of savings accounts. And we can, and if we don't tap out the account, there's actually the equivalent of kind of interest that is sustainable and livable, both from an environmental and from economic perspective. And I think that's a really a model of kind of positive development that we might hope to see more of.
We're really destroying ourselves very slowly, Andy, environmentally, socially, politically, economically. There was a famous biologist, excuse me, see if I can remember his name right, I think it was Ernst Mayr, who wrote about species have a way of annihilating, of disappearing, I think, after around 100,000 years, many of them. There's so many species in world history. And he mentioned that the human species may end up the first one ever self-destructing by the way it's going. And he mentioned that he thought that the human species has been around close to 100,000 years, so it may be getting close to the point where it will simply eliminate itself. And what other species goes around killing its own kind? Other species will kill to eat, or, you know, to protect themselves if they're threatened, but they don't go around indiscriminately killing for the sake of killing. And the human species is the only one that does that. And there are so many ways they can do it. I mean, you can fight wars. You can destroy the environment. You can kill people's social rights. I mean, you can literally starve them to death or prevent them from getting essential medical care. How many people around the world die every year because they simply can't be treated for the illnesses that they have? I mean, and there are many of them. Starvation is a big problem. So people die for a lot of reasons. Deaths by these reasons, I think, exceed the deaths by wars. And it's been a while, but I've mentioned some of this stuff in articles. It's been a good while since I've touched on that. But it really is a horrific story. And indeed, the human species may be the first one to destroy itself. And we're taking great strides to do it. And the more improved technology gets, the easier it is for it to be done. And I'm very mindful of what Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein said about another war. And Russell said something to the effect that we either have a choice, we need to live in peace, or we're going to destroy ourselves. And Einstein said that he had no idea what weapons would be used in World War III. But in World War IV, he said we'd be using sticks and stones. Well, I'll do him one better. There won't be a World War IV because there won't be a world to fight a World War IV in if there's a World War III. That's how bad it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, we don't want to be ostrich-like and stick our heads in the sand, but at the same time, I have a young niece who I love dearly and a slightly older nephew whom I also love dearly, and I think we can't allow ourselves to become too pessimistic. We have to be realistic, but not pessimistic. One of the contributions to this year's book is a chapter by Ken Burrows, who teaches at San Francisco State, and Dr. Michael Nagler, who's the director of the Meta Center for Peace and Nonviolence here in Sonoma County. And in their chapter on the creative tension of the emerging future, they quote Martin Luther King Jr. to the effect of, "We harnessed anger under discipline for maximum effect." And I think that's a powerful, if less well-known, quotation from the great Martin Luther King Jr., the idea of harnessing anger under discipline for maximum effect. And I think when we talk about the environment, in many ways we're talking about many of the issues that Martin Luther King Jr. and others, Gandhi, were talking about, that Ken Burrows and Michael Nagler in this chapter address. And one of the things that they talk about, Burroughs and Nagler, that is now, is we've all heard in terms of environmental issues about our footprint on the environment and so forth, but they also introduce a positive concept that is in some ways the parallel or runs alongside our ecological footprint, which is a quantitative measure of our individual negative impact on the planet. They also talk about the idea of having an ecological handprint, and your handprint is defined qualitatively in terms of the community participation and community development that you engage in. So mobilizing for stronger communities with less impact on the environment. And Burroughs and Nagler's chapter in the Censored Book in many ways is addressing some of that, the pessimism that you've expressed and that I, you know, in many ways share as well. But they're looking at things like how we can redefine our understandings of wealth and the economy, how we can develop education that is integrative so that we have a better relationship, a more informed and wise relationship with technology, how we can have leadership that is premised on meaningful trust and efforts in search of the common good and fundamental human dignity. And I think that's such an important area when we talk, as we do at Project Censored, so much about what's wrong and what's negative and what needs fixing, to come back to that idea of, well, we'll destroy ourselves individually if we're always on the critique, and that the critiques need to be balanced with affirmation. We need, in King's words, you know, we need to harness that anger to move forward in a positive way.
Andy, my optimism is that, and again, I've touched on this and I've written about it, and I've quoted, and there was a book I reviewed on this topic, that people, when they resist effectively, can really bring about change, and they simply don't know that the power that they have. And in America alone, there have been wonderful social justice struggles that were won because people were committed for change. They did it nonviolently. They stuck it out for the longer term. And the energy didn't wane until victories were won. The only problem is that even when you win a victory, the energy cannot wane because the bastards will take it right back from you. And that's exactly what's happened with labor rights and with civil rights. And instead of chattel slavery, we have wage slavery. It goes on and on and on. But
yes, we must be persistent. But I think, you know, one of the things, and again, this is an area where the corporate media does us a disservice. We don't hear the good news stories either. So our number seven story this year, and I know we're nearing the end of the hour, so I'll be quick. Our number seven story is that 2012 is the International Year of Cooperatives. According to the United Nations, nearly a billion people worldwide are co-op member owners. The co-op is expected to be the world's fastest growing business model by the year 2025. And this is so key because worker-owned co-ops provide for equitable distribution of wealth, for real connection to the workplace. And those are key components of a sustainable economy, key components of you know, of human life with dignity. And so we had Susan Van Gelder of Yes Magazine on the Project Censored radio show a couple weeks ago. And I asked her, I asked her, I said, Sarah, how come a story like this, UN, United Nations, International Year of the Co-op, how come that doesn't get corporate media attention? It's a good story. It's a powerful story. And she said, well, they don't have the million-dollar advertising budgets, right? These stories just, you know, they fall by the wayside. And so, Steve, you're so right. We have to be relentless in our efforts on behalf of you know, human dignity and justice.
Oh, indeed, so, Andy. And the cooperative story is marvelous. I had no idea it was a billion people. I know there's a lot of cooperative activity in Venezuela, but Venezuela has, 27 million people, so a billion people involved. I mean, this is absolutely extraordinary. Maybe in 10 years it could be 2 billion people. Self-sufficiency, people on their own deciding that they can do things by bonding together, and they do it, and they create results, and they shut out the system that exploits them and harms them. What a marvelous story. That really is a marvelous story. We're just about out of time, Andy. Wind it up with a couple of final thoughts.
Yeah, well, all the stories we've talked about this morning, your audience can find at our projectcensored.org website. They're all online in summary form. And indeed, we started the hour by talking about the long-term patterns. And you can go back on our website again. We have archived the top 25 stories for every year of Project Censored's existence, going all the way back to 1976. So, Steve, it's always a pleasure to be on the Progressive Radio News Hour. The Progressive Radio News Network does just the kind of thing we're talking about at Project Censored. We're in it together on the idea that citizens and community members need to be informed so that we can engage in democratic self-government and pursue the lives with dignity and justice that we all desire.
Andy, absolutely. It was a pleasure to have you on. I look forward to having you back. And I want to end the program by mentioning again the new volume is called Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. You and Mickey Huff put the book together. It is crammed with vital information. Anybody can buy it on the Project Censored website, or they can go to Amazon and they can order it. It's available. I've got a copy sitting right in front of me. I just can't imagine that everybody would not want to have a copy of this book. And every year when the new book comes out, get it and go through it and read the most important stories that you'll never get in the corporate media, but you'll get in this book and a whole lot more, the real news, the vital news, and that's the beginning of activism for change. Andy, again, my great thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Steve.
And I'll remind my listeners, of course I do all the time, we're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.